Hey, my name's Otis Gray, host of the Daily Book Club, a daily podcast where I read wonderful old books one chapter at a time. Simple as that. Whether you want to get engaged and lost in a fascinating story that has stood the test of time, or just relax to a good book, listen to the Daily Book Club to get wrapped up or unwind during your day. We'll read classic stories like Pride and Prejudice, The Enchanted April, The Wind in the Willows, beautiful stories all told from start to finish. And you can even do a real book club. Tune into the Daily Book Club Discord and discuss the readings with other book club listeners. However you want to listen, it's your choice. Subscribe to the Daily Book Club on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, and everywhere else. New episodes every single day. So sit back, relax, and get lost in the Daily Book Club.
Amateur Traveler, episode 851. Today, the Amateur Traveler talks about cleats and coffin, jibs and bollards, and Asclepius, as we go sailing in the Saronic Islands and the Peloponnese of Greece. This is Chris Christensen from Amateur Traveler. Let's talk about sailing in Greece. Welcome to the show. This is Chris, and this is one of those episodes that I'm doing without a guest because it is from my own travels. And this is a trip that has been a long time in the making. Years ago, more than a decade ago, my wife decided that for one of her even-numbered birthdays, one of those round-numbered birthdays, she wanted to do a cruise in the Greek Isles with friends of ours. And when we said a cruise, she had in mind a small boat cruise. And we honestly didn't really know what that meant exactly. We didn't know how small a boat was a small boat. Was this a yacht we were talking about, or was it a small cruise ship or whatever? How many people did she want to have on board? What places did she want to go? It was fairly undefined, and that's probably one of the reasons that round birthdays came and went. Birthdays that end in five came and went. Our kids got married. We have one grandkid, and still we hadn't pulled this trip off. Of course, there was a pandemic in the middle of that also. But this year, we've been talking a lot on the Amateur Traveler about Greece, and one of the reasons we've been talking about it, well, two reasons. One is that Greece is a really fascinating destination, and I'm a big fan of Greece. I'm a fan of the food, I'm a fan of the history, fan of the scenery. So it's a wonderful country to go to, and we hadn't covered it in a while. And two is I was planning on going to Greece this year, and so we've done more coverage probably than we have in some time on Greece for 2023. And I was planning on going because the travel conference that I go to 2-3 times a year, the TBEX conference, Travel Blog Exchange conference, was going to be in Kalamata in the Peloponnese, that southern portion of Greece. And so I told my wife, hey, I'm going to Greece. Someone is going to buy me a ticket and take me to Greece. This is the year we should do that trip. This is the year we should find out what it is we want to do. And do it. Round up some friends and go sailing in the Greek islands. But again, we didn't know exactly what that meant. We looked at cruises. We looked at small boat cruises. We looked at renting a yacht or a sailboat and really hadn't pulled the trigger on anything. And I think it's quite possible that the whole opportunity would have come and gone, except that I coincidentally got an email from a company called Navigare Yachting. And Navigare is, I am told, has one of the largest fleets worldwide of charterable sailboats, catamarans, monohulls, a variety of different styles. And they said, hey, would you be willing to talk about us on your show in exchange for the use of a yacht for a week? To which my response was, you don't happen to have any yachts in Athens, do you? And as it turns out, they've got 40 different yachts in Athens. And so we did this trip sponsored by Navigare, where they paid for the yacht, and I'll talk about costs later on of what this would cost you. And then we paid for a crew, a captain and a host, and I'll talk about what a host does in a bit, as well as port fees and food and water and fuel and all the other things that would cost you to do this trip if you were going to do it yourself. And so we finally were able to pull this together. We pulled together four different friends, one couple and two single friends, one of whom was one of our daughter's best friends from high school, so our Israeli daughter, who lives in Israel now. And traveled together to Athens, saw Athens for about 3 days, which I'm not going to talk about so much. We saw a lot of the historic places that we talked about on the recent episode to Athens. And then we did a sailing trip. We did a sailing trip out to the Saronic Islands, which we talked about relatively recently, and to some of the ports of the Peloponnese. So we're going to cover some of the same information that we've covered recently, but from a very different perspective because it's a very different trip. We talked about it recently of doing the trip down to the Peloponnese by bus, and this has some of the same destinations, but without the bus journey, and instead you're sailing by boat. There was a moment well into our trip, and I'll talk about it later, but we climbed a hill in one of the particular ports we were in. We're in the port of Paros, just off the Peloponnese in one of these islands, of the Saronic Islands. And we were by the clock tower there, this iconic blue clock tower that's up the hill in Paros. And we stood there and we sat on a bench for 15, 20 minutes just gazing at the beautiful scenery. Happened to be a beautiful day with this blue, blue water in front of us and sailboats in every direction. Watched ferries go off towards Athens. And my wife said, this is the money shot. This is what I had in mind for this trip. But before we got there, there were a lot of different decisions we had to make. And it's one of the reasons why I thought this warranted its own show. Because I thought the idea of, hey, let's just do a sailing trip would be a little easier than it was. Certainly before we were contacted by Navigear, as we were trying to find out who we could rent from and where did you get a crew and did you get them from the same people or did you find them separately, it all seemed a little too complicated. But once we started the process with Navigear, they started with, well, what kind of boat do you want? And there are monohull boats and there are catamarans. And the monohull boats, we learned from our later on from our captain, Kostos, whose wisdom will pepper this particular episode, are what the sailors usually rent. So people who are doing bare boating, people who are approved to do sailing in Greece, have got all their paperwork in, are competent sailors who can get in and out of ports, which is a little more complicated in Greece. And we'll talk about parking a boat in Greece, which is a little different procedure. But the people who can do that and want to do their own sailing typically rent a monohull. And the reason for that is they're a little more fun to sail. So if you're a sailor and you could do it on your own, that's usually the direction that people go. For those of us who knew that we had no such capabilities and were looking to hire a crew to take us around, then a catamaran is the typical choice, as it was for us, because it has a lot more space. If you're passing a monohull, you'll see, when you're sailing or cruising, if you're passing a monohull, you'll see all the people typically sitting in the back in the cockpit, which is right where the captain is, and there's kind of one table that people are sitting around, and that's a pretty typical configuration for monohulls. That's the public space. You've got some small cabins down below, possibly smaller than they are in the catamaran also, but then one kind of public space up here in the cockpit. On the catamaran, by contrast, we ate most of our meals on what would amount to the back deck of the catamaran, behind a set of glass doors that you can close that are at the interior of the boat. And there's a table there, and there's seating enough for the 8 people that you could take as passengers on the boat, plus some other seating as well back there. You could probably seat 12, 16 people in that back deck of the catamaran. There was also then seating probably up on the top, near where the captain was, for another 8 people. On a bright sunny day, it's great to sit up there on the top as you're sailing. In the front of the boat, if you wanted to sun yourself, whatever, there's cushions and such on the boat we were on, which is the Ocean's 12, for probably another 6 to 8 people. And then there was the interior of the boat where the kitchen was, where the host was cooking, and there's another table and set of chairs there. You could also seat 8 people. And so there's plenty of space on this boat. And then you have 4 small cabins and then 2 what they call coffins, and that's where the crew cabins are. They're in the front of the boat in this particular configuration, and they don't have any windows. They're relatively small. In fact, our captain preferred to sleep in the kitchen area on one of the couches there and just used his particular cabin for storage for extra luggage or something like that if people had things that they needed to store. But one of the first decisions we had is which boat. So we chose catamaran, and then which detail boat you, as you're looking at the different types of boats, ours was rated, for instance, a 4+2. And that meaning four cabins plus two crew cabins. And then it was rated for 8+2 or 8 people plus 2 crew. Even with that, it only had 4 toilets in each of our cabins. And so the crew needed to borrow a toilet when they needed to take a shower or use the restroom. All of the toilets, of course, on a boat are going to be marine toilets. Nothing that doesn't come out of you gets flushed. One of the first things we learned in our orientation to the boat, as well as the safety talk. I'm going to talk about the itinerary, and then I'm going to go back and talk about some of the questions that we asked that you might have as you're thinking about this kind of trip on your own, including costs. So Navigare sails their boats out of a port that is near Athens, a little further south than the main port of Piraeus. And so we arranged for transportation to take us from our hotel in Athens, where we had been for 3 days, down to the port at the end of Saturday. So we joined the boat on Saturday, and then we would sail until the following Saturday. And that's pretty typical for a one-week sailing. They also do two-week sailings. As you're looking at a one-week itinerary from Athens, if you're thinking about heading down to Mykonos and Santorini and some of the well-known islands in Greece, it's really a little too far to go. They recommend that if you wanted to do that kind of sailing trip, which we've talked about a little bit years ago on the show, that you think about a two-week trip. We only had 1 week in our itinerary, and so they recommended the Saronic Islands and bits of the Peloponnese. So you're sailing out of Athens, and you're sailing basically along the edge of the body of land that starts with Corinth and is that southern peninsula of Greece. And the Saronic Islands are just off the coast of the Peloponnese. And our original itinerary would call for us to go not quite as far as we ended up going, as we looked at sort of the typical itineraries that they recommend. You head as far as maybe Spetses, which we'll talk about later, and you spend your time sailing between these tiny islands. But we went in May, and one of the things that I'd say is, in terms of when to go, the first part of May is what worked for us, but I wouldn't recommend it for you. And the reason for that is the weather hasn't quite warmed up yet. We had more rain showers on about a third of the days we had rain. And also then the water hasn't warmed up as much. It was less busy than it would be in the middle of summer, and that was nice, and things were open, and that was good, but it really was the beginning of the season. It was our Captain Costas's first trip of the season, and so he would be sailing then from basically the beginning of May or the later last week of April into late into September at least. And he recommends that the best time to do this would be late September. In the middle of the year, in July and August, it's going to be quite crowded. You're not going to be able to find space in ports. There's going to be more people there. It's going to be lively and interesting, and the weather's going to be hot. And so it's going to be great to get in the water. But if you go in late September, the water's still warm, the weather's still good, and the things are still open. If you go too late in the season, then the islands tend to work on really a six-month-on schedule, and they close up. And so whether you're doing this trip by bus, as we talked about before, or by sailboat, you really want to do it more in the shoulder season, into the summer, into the fall shoulder season as well. But because we were going in May and we weren't going to have as much beach time, we weren't going to be swimming as much, Costas recommended that we go a little further. And we actually went down to the city we talked about within the last year on Amateur Traveler, of Monemvasia. And I actually had plans to go there the next week as part of a press trip, but I was really excited to get there. It is an amazing city, was the highlight of the trip. So I was pleased that the people I was traveling with, my friends and my wife, were able to go down to Monemvasia and see that amazing old historic town. But I get ahead of myself. So we met up with the captain and our host. And when I say host, one of the other decisions you have in terms of crewing is, if you can't drive the sailboat yourself like we are, then you need a captain for sure. Somebody's going to get you in and out of ports and is going to sail the boat and make sure you don't hit container ships on the way or reefs or whatever else. But then you have a choice also. Do you want a cook or a host, or you're going to do everything yourself. So you can just get a captain, even if you don't know how to captain a boat, and then do all your own cooking and cleaning and those sorts of things. And that's fine. That would save you some expenses. We chose to go for a host. A host is going to cook two meals a day for you, and a cook is going to cook roughly three meals a day. We thought that going out on some of these islands would be fun. So the host typically is going to cook your breakfast and your lunch meal. We were told that typically the lunch meal is a lighter fare than what we had. Our host, Panos, was actually a restaurant owner when he wasn't doing this. So he does this part-time and a chef. And so we had an amazing midday meal that was usually our biggest and most elaborate and most delicious meal of the day. But that isn't necessarily what you're going to get. It's depending a little bit on what your host is capable of and also what you're looking for. Because we gave Panos an idea of what kind of things we like to eat. There weren't a lot of big seafood eaters on the trip, for instance. So we had a lot less seafood than he would be used to making on one of these trips. Because he's going to tailor the menu to the people on the boat. And then one of the great things about working with Navigear was that we went to them and we got everything. We basically got the itinerary. We had consultation with them. We got the captain. We got the host. We got the boat. They dealt with the port fees, filling up the boat with water, getting us in and out of ports. All of those sorts of things were dealt with by dealing with one particular company. So that first night, we sailed to the island of Aegina. And Aegina is the big island you see when you're in the major port of Athens, or even from the Parthenon. If you look down into the sea off the coast of Athens, you can see a great big island there, and that's the island of Aegina. There have been people on the island for at least 7,000 years. There are traces of civilization for that entire time period. And it was a major island in Greek history. But the first night, we didn't sail to the major city of Aegina, which is Aegina, but to a smaller port, to the port of Perdica. And Perdica is in the southwest corner of the island. And we got there a little after dark. I had enough time left in the day to get off the boat and go into the port to where the number of seafood restaurants were, or tavernas along the water's edge, and have a nice meal for our first evening's meal. One of the things I have to say about getting off the boat, and this took us a little bit by surprise, the way you park a boat most places in Greece is a little different than I'm familiar with sailboats. I'm used to sailboats that there are lots and lots of docks and lots of places to park in a marina, and you pull up alongside of one, and you tie up, and when you want to get off, you step off the boat onto the dock. But the way it happens in Greece is a little different. At almost every place that we docked the boat, we would drop the anchor maybe 100 feet offshore and then back into the dock, dragging the anchor until it sets and the anchor cable. And our captain would say that both the anchor and the anchor cable are a part of the system that keeps the boats in place. It's the weight of both that anchor the boat. And then we'd pull up to the dock, but we wouldn't quite pull all the way up to the dock. We would tend to pull up about 4 feet away from the dock, and then we would tie up the two endpoints on the stern of the boat to either cleats or loops or bollards on the dock. This is a nautical term that I had to learn. So a loop is when it's just a loop of iron, and a cleat is that thing you're used to seeing that has two points going out to the left and right where you're wrapping the rope around it. And then a bollard is one of the more substantial knobs that sticks out that you tie up a boat to. And you'd have some of those on the dock and you tie up, but then the back of the boat is still 4 feet or so from the dock. And that's a long step. And so there was a plank basically that was put from the boat to the dock, and to get from one to the other, you would walk across this fairly narrow, I would say 10-inch plank from the boat to the dock and the dock to boat. And it wouldn't always be flat. Sometimes at certain docks, it would be flat across, and other times you'd be walking uphill to get onto the dock. And so that's one of the things you need to know, is if you're going to do this in Greece, you need to be a little sure on your feet to do this. You can certainly get a hand up from someone on the dock who's ahead of you, and from somebody on the boat, which helps your assuredness. But that was one of the things that took us a little bit by surprise as we're walking the plank to get on and off the boat. in the various ports, including when we first got on the boat in Athens. The other thing I think that came a little bit by surprise is you're on a sailboat, but it doesn't mean you're always sailing. So the first day, for instance, we were sailing directly into a 15-kilometer-an-hour breeze. It was a bit choppy, and we also had some miles to get to. And if you're sailing, it's going to be slower. And because we were going further on our itinerary this time, we actually didn't do a lot of time with the sails up. We were mostly cruising and motoring on our particular boat. And so if you want to do more sailing, when you're originally making your itinerary, you need to make it a little shorter. So you just need to make choices. Would you want to see more places, see a greater range of places, which was our choice, or do you want to do more actual time with the sails up? And then, of course, it will depend on the weather as well. We had times where we had very little wind and times where we had quite a lot of wind. And so we did have times where we sailed with the jib up, but I don't know that we ever actually saw the mainsail on our particular voyage, and it's really going to depend on your priorities in terms of what you want to see and how much you want to actually sail.
ButcherBox is sponsoring this episode of Amateur Traveler, and I just got my first ButcherBox. I've got packed with dry ice came 4 packets of ground beef, 3 packets of chicken breasts, 2 steaks, some pork ribs, and some sirloin tips. Now, I've got a great recipe for what to do with the chicken. At least one of those packets of chicken is going to become Greek chicken and rice. And if you go to chris2x.com, I've got a recipe there that's an Instant Pot recipe. But I'm not good with steak, and so I'm going to take advantage of the fact that ButcherBox has recipes on their site at butcherbox.com to learn some great recipes to do with those steaks. You can have ButcherBox deliver meat to your doorstep. Free shipping as always, curated to custom box plans. You can easily find high-quality meat and seafood you can trust. 100% grass beef, free-range organic chicken, pork-raised crate-free, and wild-caught seafood. Humanely raised, no antibiotics or added hormones. Also like the fact that I could recycle all the box and shipping material that they sent. Sign up at butcherbox.com/traveler and get our special deal. ButcherBox is offering our listeners a free for a year offer plus an additional 20% off. Choose salmon, chicken, breast, or steak tips free in every order for a year. Sign up today at butcherbox.com/traveler. If you got recipes for ribs or steaks, send them my way as I send my thanks to ButcherBox.com for sponsoring this episode of Amateur Traveler.
The second day we sailed, and this was a kind of a typical pattern where we'd get up and it was relatively calm, maybe a 3-kilometer-per-hour wind, and we cruised up past Poros up to Hydra or Hydra. And this is a well-known island that we've talked about on the show before, where no cars allowed, beautiful, picturesque, very, very tiny harbor. And so we were able to find a place in the harbor, but our captain has done maybe 100 trips to Hydra and has found a place in the harbor. This was the 4th time. And so it's someplace where typically he'd have to move us a couple coves over, and then we would call a water taxi to get us into the main harbor. But fortunately, we had some luck with us, as well as we were very early in the season. And so we parked the boat again, dropping the anchor, backing it into the dock here with this beautiful view of the town of Hydra. There's only one town on the island. There's only about 2,000 people on the island total, although about 300 churches, oddly enough. And when we talked about Hydra before on Amateur Traveler, our guest Sally Jane on the episode on the Peloponnese, episode 833, talked about walking up to the monastery of Elijah the prophet up on the top of the island. And most of these islands are very mountainous, as are the Peloponnese. It's really very stunning geology, where a lot of the cities behind the city is granite rock, almost bare granite rock, that often reminded me of the Sierras, the mountains near my home. We did not hike up to the monastery and the island, which there was always a monastery and always a hike, because we were just coming off of 3 days of hiking up all the hills in Athens. We did some of the walks along the shore, as you can walk along the edge of the shore of Hydra. And the island is just covered in trails. And so if you're looking for an island to spend some time and do some hiking, we know that a friend of ours, Tim Luffel, who's another travel writer, actually spent a week there coinciding with our visit. And he spent some time doing his travel writing, but they also spent some time doing the hikes. And the hike up to the monastery, for instance, was an hour of uphill climb and then 450 stairs up to the top. I have to say that the port in Idra, the port when you're looking at all the shops and all of the restaurants which are there along this tiny port, and we're parked here. This is our boat. This is our view. This is our hotel room for the night, is this view. It just felt a very special privilege to be able to live this kind of life, even for a week. It just felt like, okay, we're boat people now. This is something that I could get used to. Just a beautiful little city. And I was surprised on this island, as well as the other ones we went to, that you would go out to the tiny restaurants here in the harbor. Clearly had a lot of tourists coming into town. And yet things were not as expensive as I expected them to be. I think if they were in the U.S., the prices would have been hiked up probably twice as much as we were seeing there. We would go out to dinner at night for maybe $10 to $20 per person, depending on how much room we had to eat after whatever Panos had cooked us for lunch, for one thing. And then the following day, we did our biggest sail, and that was the sail to Bonavacia. We broke that into two parts. We sailed over to a port along the Peloponnese, a rugged coastline. A coastline is so rugged here that the city we stopped at for lunch, which is Kiparisi, didn't even have roads coming to it until the 1960s. It was just too rugged a coastline to build roads across. And so until the 1960s, this town existed only being supplied by water. It was a fishing village, and everything came in and out via boat. So there is a road now that you can connect to the mainland, but still a very rugged and beautiful terrain. We stopped there. Panos cooked us lunch as we explored the town, and then we sailed on to Bonavacia. And Bonavacia, again, we talked about in the episode of Peloponnese, but someplace I would definitely recommend going. And one of the reasons I wanted to go was that episode that we did, because I'd really not heard of Bonavacia before that. But this is a town that is one of the longest occupied, fortified cities in Europe. And I didn't catch when we did our previous show of when it was occupied, but basically the city of ancient Sparta was continuously occupied up until the 6th century. And in the 6th century, there were invasions, first by some of the Goths and then by some of the Slavic tribes. And at some point, the city of Sparta was abandoned in the 6th century, and the people took refuge here and fortified this rock of an island off the coast of the Peloponnese called Bonavacia. And so it's this great big rock, like the Rock of Gibraltar is what it reminds people of, with a lower town below, which takes up a relatively tiny, compact portion of the island. And then the upper town, the top of the rock, is about three times the size, but is no longer inhabited. And so up on the upper town is really mostly ruins at this point, except for a church, the Church of Hagia Sophia, and then the gatehouse that was still occupied by soldiers up until more recent centuries is still largely intact. And you can get from the lower town to the upper town via a series of zigzag steps and stairs and pathways going up. We sailed past Bonavacia, which was nice to be able to see it from the ocean. I was there twice within the last 2 weeks. I was there first on the boat and then came back with a press trip. And I was glad I did, because when we were there the first time with the sailboat, we parked in the new town, which is not on the island but on the mainland, and then walked the 35 minutes out to the old town to have dinner and to explore the town and walk out to the lighthouse at the end of the rock. And then we started to climb up to the top, and the climb itself was tiring for sure, but main reason we did not go all the way to the top was that all of the paving in the town is stone, and it was raining or had rained while we were there, and all of the stone was wet and was fairly treacherous not to go up but to go down. So at least one person who had her arm in a makeshift sling because she had taken a fall on the way down, coming down from the old town. And so we went partway up till we could get a great view and then headed back down and explored the old town more. But I was able the next week when I was there in sunlight to get up to the top and to explore some of the old ruins up there and see the outside of the Church of Hagia Sophia. It's still open if you go up before 5 o'clock, but we were there later in the day, closer to sunset. Beautiful, amazing city with just these great views. I say it's still continuously inhabited, although really only about 10 inhabitants on a permanent basis within Monemvasia right now. And then a lot of hotels, as we talked about, that are these guest houses that are using various rooms in the different buildings. And so it's not one big hotel building, but a series of rooms that are connected in form a logical hotel. Although when you stay there, as I did the second time there, and you're trying to get your wheeled suitcase across town, I tell you that really beats up a wheeled suitcase pretty badly, because there's nothing like a flat path and you end up carrying your suitcase up and down steps, and it's a fairly good workout. And what I would recommend, what I didn't think to do until afterwards, was we had a bus. I could have left most of my belongings in the bus and just brought in a change of clothes for one night. And certainly if you're doing that, bring a backpack, bring as little as you need, because getting your luggage across Monemvasia is going to be a bit of a chore. And then that night, we actually did some night sailing because there was going to be some rougher weather in the morning. And so Costas, our captain, said he actually loves doing night sailing. So he sailed us back to the same town where we had had lunch, back to the harbor in Caprisi, where we were overlooking, when we woke up, these rugged mountains over the city of Caprisi as we woke up in a harbor across the way. Parked, as it turns out, next to a boat of high school students from a college prep high school in Rhode Island, St. George's High School, who were there on a 4-week sailboat trip, which I think is better than any field trip I had ever done in high school by a lot. We then sailed back to the town of Spetses. Spetses was probably our worst weather day. When we got there, we just spent some time hanging out on the boat waiting for the rain to pass. Spetses was very important in the beginning of the Greek War of Independence. It was the first of the islands that declared its independence from Turkey in 1821 and provided some of the sailors and some of the boats for the original Greek Navy in that War of Independence. There's still some wooden boatworks on the island. If you go over to the old harbor there, you can see that as you're going towards the lighthouse. And that's one of the highlights, I think, of Spetses. There was also a museum that we did not get to about that early history of the War of Independence and the island of Spetses. Our next day was the island of Poros, which I mentioned was that money shot, that time where we were up there by the clock tower looking down at all the sailboats. We were actually there the day before a big sailboat open house, as it were. It was a boat show featuring all the different yachts from different rental companies where you could rent a boat in Greece. And there's quite a few of them. Navigare is not the only one, although certainly it's my favorite right now. They also had some of the new Navigare boats there that are even larger than the Ocean's 12 that we had, some of the larger catamarans and things like that, which was just interesting to see. Not that we regretted our choice. The larger boat would cost more money, of course, for a week's long rental. The one that we did was about $6,000 for a week-long rental, the Ocean's 12. And then our next day was intended to be on a deserted island where we would do some swimming, some snorkeling, and do a picnic on the beach, but it really wasn't the right weather for it. And so Costas instead suggested, how about we go instead to Epidaurus? And Epidaurus, as we talked about in the Peloponnese show, is where you can find the ancient theater there, known for its acoustics. There are some rumors that the other people in my group had an impromptu concert in the theater to try out the acoustics, but they have no proof of that. Besides the theater is the ruins of an ancient healing center, and the ancient healing center dedicated to the Greek god Asclepius. And the theater itself was because they thought that watching dramatic performances was good for your mental and physical health, which I thought was centuries ahead of their time. And then our last stop, our last port of call, was the city of Aegina on the island of Aegina. And we stopped there on our way back that last day from Epidaurus to Athens and had lunch in Aegina and also explored the Temple to Apollo. So up on a hill above the city is the older city mound. This portion of the city dates back to being inhabited for about 7,000 years. There's a great little museum there that had pottery from the various times. And if you've spent time in Athens, for instance, and you've gone to the ancient Agora and to the museum there, it's a similar sort of thing where you can walk through and you can recognize, you know, Paleolithic artwork and pottery, and then you can start to recognize the pottery that would happen in the time of the Mycenaeans, back in the time of the Trojan War, and then you can clearly recognize the classical Greek pottery that looks like it's right out of the Disney movie Hercules with the amazing drawings on the side of it and such. You can see the development of the civilization just in these pottery pieces that have been put back together from this long history there on the island of Aegina. And I say Aegina is one of the places that I think I was most attracted to. It felt a little more like a real world town with, you know, some good shopping, some good restaurants. It was a little larger town. And then this ancient history there as well. If I was going to spend some time on one of the islands and just hang out and get some work done, I think Aegina might be one of the places that I would go. I should have apologized at the beginning of this episode. I put off this episode for a week or two after getting back from my trip, in part because I wanted to get my pictures together, in part I wanted to finish a blog post, a 4,200-word blog post about most of the things I'm talking to you about today, about sailing in the Greek islands. But also, I needed my voice to recover because I came back with a cold and a cough. And so I'm mainlining cough drops at this point. I apologize for the rough edges of my voice, but it's not quite as bad as the episodes that I did in the last couple weeks here, the intro and the outro, which were recorded with right in the middle of that cold. So some of the things to think about if you're thinking about doing this yourself. Let's talk about costs. This is the end of the article I wrote, but let's jump right in here. So I thought it was a fairly affordable trip for the type of trip this is, which is a luxury experience. Luxury in some ways, but not in others, in the sense that your cabin is relatively small. You're not going to want to overpack for sure in terms of what you're going to bring, because, you know, sailboat cabins aren't all that big. But the boat itself had a lot of space, and the food, of course, as you have somebody who is doing the cooking for you for two meals a day or three meals a day if you get a cook, it makes it, I think, really more into a luxury experience. And that really was, you know, a treat to have somebody not just doing the cooking for us, but doing the cooking very well for us. And it really was something we would do this again. But the main costs that I gathered together were the yacht itself. The boat would be about $6,000, depending on the boat and depending on the time period. The food for the boat for a week, mostly purchased up front, but then some other water and things purchased along the way, was about $819. Meat separate from that was from the butcher was another $142. Fuel, because we sailed as far as we did to Monemvasia, was a little more. It was at $790 for that. And because we didn't do as much time sailing. So if you do more sail-rich experience, that would come down. But, you know, fuel is expensive in Greece, in Europe these days. And then we got the Navigair Carefree package. And that was basically, you know, your bedding was covered. Your Wi-Fi was covered in there. Insurance, welcome package, final cleaning, towels, bed sheets, the fuel for the dinghy, all those sorts of things. So that added up to another $549. The skipper was a little over $1,600. The host a little more than $1,200 for the week. The crew tips were about 15 to 25% is what they recommended. So I'm putting about 20% in there, $580. Transfers to and from the boat, which we purchased through Navigair, another $200. So it came to about $11,400 total. But we had six people in the boat, so it was about $1,900 each. Which really isn't bad if you compare that to a week-long cruise. And then, of course, the cabins would hold eight. We had two singles who were not sharing a cabin, and so if we'd had eight people on the boat, that really would have knocked the price down to about $1,400 each, which really isn't bad for a week's-long vacation where that's lodging, transportation, and two meals a day. So we basically walked away from this saying we would do this again. You know, obviously if Navigair sponsored us, sure. But even without Navigair sponsoring us, this is something that I would do again. And in terms of where we would go again, we've talked about doing this in Croatia, which is one of the many countries that Navigare is in. Navigare is in Croatia, the Virgin Islands, Bahamas, Greece, the Seychelles, Spain, Thailand, and Turkey. But we would also think about that two-week trip down into the northern Cyclades Islands. And Costas had a particular itinerary that he recommended for us. If we could get the gang back together again with Panos cooking and Costas guiding us, I think we would do that. Now, one of the funny things about Costas is there's a apocryphal story, apparently, among skippers about a skipper who was hired to take people down to the Cyclades, down to the well-known islands down there, who instead just sailed them basically to Aegina, and he would spent the week instead sailing around the island and every day announcing a new port that it really wasn't the port of. And so every port we went to, Costas would say, "Welcome to Mykonos." So some questions to think about if you're doing this on your own, questions that we had. So should you do it with a crew? For us, the answer was obviously yes. For you, it depends on whether you are sailors and whether you want to do that experience, but it was a great experience. Both of the crew members really added to our experience for us. And I've got pictures of some of the food that Panos was making for us, and you'll see why I said that if you look at the article that is accompanying this particular podcast. When did we contact the skipper and the host? So we really didn't contact them until a week or two before the trip. And then we got their contact information. And with the skipper, with Costas, we talked about our itinerary, where we wanted to go. He suggested some different things that we were thinking about, which we enjoyed doing. And then with the host, that's where he started learning, well, what do you eat? What don't you eat? And started putting together an itinerary. And then with some of the things we had read on the Navigare site, it was you may go shopping with your host. Although in our case, we found that Panos did all of the meal planning and we got there and the groceries were just showing up. And so we basically just paid a big meat meal and paid a big grocery bill. And he did all of the, you know, putting away of the groceries, the preparing of the groceries. You had to fight him if you wanted to wash a dish. What should you pack? I've got a packing list that comes from Navigare with some suggestions for me as well in the article, so I'm not going to go through that in details, but it is a relaxing, non-fancy vacation. You certainly can bring clothes if you want to dress up and go out to dinner at the various ports. We did not dress up so much. There was certainly no problem at any of the ports going to the tavernas. They were right there on the waterfront. They were used to people stepping off of their boats and coming and having dinner there. So it really is more of a t-shirt and shorts kind of thing in the winter. We wore a few more long pants on that, doing it in May. Multiple swimsuits if you're doing more in the warmer time of year, because putting on a wet swimsuit is no fun. And then some of the surprises. So we did the Navigare package. That meant we did have Wi-Fi almost the whole week. Sometimes we'd get far enough from shore where we wouldn't, but because you're sailing along the coast of the Peloponnese, really most of the time I could have done work for my office from the boat successfully and productively. I chose not to. I did some amateur traveler work, but basically I was posting things and using the Wi-Fi, and I would say it was no worse and probably better than a lot of the big cruise ships that I have been on, because there were really only 6 passengers on this boat, you know, sharing a Wi-Fi hotspot. I also did buy extra data plan for my cell phone while I was there. And we haven't talked about it on the show that much, but I used an eSIM. So most modern cell phones have the ability to do an electronic SIM, which means you're not actually using the old paperclip and pushing out your current SIM and putting in a new one, but you're adding in a virtual SIM, that card that lets you use a different phone number or different data plan, and you could have multiple ones on your iPhone or on your Samsung phone at the same time if you've got a modern phone. And I just went to eSIM.io and got a new data plan for just a few dollars for, you know, a couple gigabytes of data that served me well for doing some of the social media things that I needed to do while I was on the trip. In terms of power in the cabins, it's going to depend on the boat. Some of the boats have more of the DC plugs like you'd have if you were plugging in something in the car, and so you're going to need a DC adapter for that. Ours had a regular European type C plugs, which is the two-prong round plugs with 230 volts and 50 hertz. And so anything that can plug in with an adapter into the two-prong plugs works fine as long as it can handle that voltage. And so that's where you're going to tend to take a look at your, if you're bringing a hair dryer, if you're bringing a curling iron, you might take a look if they're a U.S. brand, they may only go to 110 volts. And if you plug them in there, even with a plug adapter, it will fry them. So you really do need a voltage adapter if you're going to plug them in on those. But we had a single round plug in the room and then three USB plugs in each of the cabinets so we could plug our devices. So that didn't end up being as much of an issue as we thought it might be. But do ask specifically about the boat that you're on. One of the questions we asked is what kind of marine life we would see. We didn't see a lot of fish except when we passed some fishing boats and things like that. But we did have a encounter with dolphins, which there's a video of on the blog post that I wrote. And then the other last question that we had was how much cash do we have to bring? And so we're so used to dealing with things via credit card, we thought we were going to have to pay for the groceries with cash or some other things that we were able to charge. So we ended up with way too much cash. But we did know that the crew's tip should be in a, you know, envelope with cash in it and handed to the captain. That was information we got from Navigator. And so we did bring enough cash to make sure that we could handle that. And we brought enough to deal with other payments along the way. It turns out we were able to charge most of those. And so we didn't need as much cash as we thought. And there were ATM machines all throughout the islands, all throughout the ports that we're at. So it would have been difficult to get more cash if we needed it. Would I do this again? Yes. It was probably one of the most relaxing trips I've ever had. And I'm a little surprised as I say that. I don't know what I was expecting, but just the 3 hours a day that we were motoring or sailing in between ports, I thought ahead of time I would spend some time during that, 1 hour doing sort of amateur traveler work and catching up and taking pictures and posting pictures and the kind of things that I need to do because I am doing a podcast and because I'm doing a blog that you won't necessarily have to do. And then 1 hour just on deck, marveling at the scenery and just enjoying the moment. And then 1 hour taking a nap. It just was a thoroughly relaxing time. Of course, rule number one, always go with the people you want to spend time with. That, you know, that's the biggest key to our success. We brought some games along for those rainy afternoons so that we were just entertaining ourselves and really didn't need to do a whole lot to have fun. So picking the people you're going with is always the most important thing for every trip. And even more so probably with the small confines of a sailboat. Even more so probably if you're doing a monohull, which has fewer places to go and hide. But it was amazing. And I think I would enjoy the trip that we talked about on the show before of doing all these things by bus or doing all these things by rental car. But it was quite different doing them by boat. And it was quite different sailing into, not just into the port, but into the sailing culture. And every time you park your boat, you'd throw somebody a line, some stranger usually, who was always helping out, and you seemed like you had joined a community just by getting on a boat. When we pulled into Paros, we pulled right in front of Taverna, the Oasis Taverna. And the Taverna was owned by a friend of Costas, and so he came up and helped us with the lines and such, as somebody would always do. But then he came and brought us a pitcher of wine to welcome us to the port. And it just felt like we were part of this community that we didn't know we were going to be part of. And especially probably because we were with Panos and Costas, who had been doing this for years, they knew people everywhere. So when we would go to a taverna, they would be greeted by the owners. You know, especially this was Costas's first cruise of the season, so they hadn't seen him in months. When we would go to a particular city, he would recommend places that we go. And so that was something that was a little bit of a surprise. And then I love sailing. I love being on a boat. Sails up, sails not up, doesn't matter too much, but I just love that experience. And this was a great way to experience that. And the Greek Isles, the Saronic Isles, and the Peloponnese are even more spectacularly beautiful than I expected. I think we underplayed that when we did the last show because of these rugged mountains along the ways. I also had a chance while I was down there to do a press trip to the area to do other places in the Peloponnese that wouldn't be sailing destinations. They were all so stunningly beautiful. The old medieval city of Mystras, the city of Kalamata, where the conference was that I went to, all beautiful places. And I can highly recommend the Peloponnese and the Saronic Islands. And getting there by boat, there's just nothing better. So the usual questions I ask at the end. You're standing in the most beautiful spot. Where you're standing, what are you looking at? For me, it's one of two things. It's either sailing around the fortress city of Manavasya, or it's that hanging out on the bench at the top of the clock tower there in Poros, just looking out at all the boats and the beautiful blue water. One thing that makes me laugh and say only in the waters of Greece, I think of the people who were bareboating, who had rented their own monohull and who were pulling out of the port of Paros, and they were trying to pull out it. It was a little past their skill set, I think. And they had, I don't know, 10, 20 people shouting them different suggestions, probably contradictory instructions, as they were trying to pull their boat out and not hit all the other boats, which I think they managed to do, but not by much. You can't pull a boat in and you can't pull a boat out without getting some suggestions from passersby who one would assume knows something about sailing, but I don't think that that would limit them if they didn't. The other two things that I thought were interesting that I didn't mention earlier that I'm thinking of as I was just thinking about this section is one that was fascinating about the boat in terms of the technology is you have the captain who is sailing the boat, and I'm sure you have this mental picture of the captain up there, and he's got a great big wheel, and he's turning the wheel, and he's got some LCD displays nowadays so that he's not looking at charts and such, but he's seeing the chart on the LCD displays. But what I wasn't picturing is that, especially when we were doing that sailing that first night, and it was chilly as we sailed past sunset, as you came inside the cabin of the boat, where you could close the glass doors and be inside, there was another whole set of LCD panels, and the captain could not just see our course and see the charts on those LCDs, but he could reset it. He could basically set waypoints on that LCD because it was a touch display, and so he didn't have to be at the wheel to be guiding the boat. And so half the time, or more than half the time, that he was guiding the boat, he was just doing it on this LCD, or he was walking around and it was being on basically autopilot. It was really as we came in and out of ports that he was always at the wheel and, you know, doing much more fine controls with the wheel. But it was fascinating seeing how a sailing ship works these days. The other thing that was a little surprising was when we got to Manavasya, we parked at a port that would have been much closer than the 35-minute walk we had from the port we ended up at. And this was a port on the northern side of the peninsula that leads out to Manavasya, or the causeway. And it would have been relatively close to the old town gate, but it was closed, we realized, after we were already almost all the way tied up. They realized that there were gates across where we would walk out from. And so they called in and, you know, got on their cell phones and found out that the whole port was closed because they had found a World War II mine and were demining that harbor. And so we had to go around Manavasya again to the other side to a newer port. But it seems weird that even in 2023, that's can be going on in Europe. But I know there are places in Europe that are still finding munitions from World War I. So I guess I shouldn't be that surprised. And then if I had to summarize this trip in just three words, what three words would I use? Views and ports. And in deference to Panos, I'll have to say, and delicious.
I'll put a link in the show notes to the article that talks about this trip in case you want to read that or pass that off to a friend who's planning this sort of trip. And that also then, of course, has a lot of my pictures from this particular trip if you haven't been looking at them through your podcast player. A special thanks goes out to the patrons of the show who help support Amateur Traveler financially and me emotionally. If you're interested in becoming a patron of the show, you can learn more by going to patreon.com/amateurtraveler.
And speaking of patrons of the show, I heard on the show that we did on San Diego from San Diego resident patron and former guest on the show, Justin Barnes, who said, "I really enjoyed all of the great recommendations. She had suggested some of the best places in both San Diego and North County, both well-known and under the radar. I only have a couple additional comments and suggestions for San Diego. First, San Diego is renowned for its speakeasies, with several across town, including both Prohibition and Young Blood in the Gas Lamp, False Idol in Little Italy, and Raised by Wolves in La Jolla. There is an excellent article on the single best place for eating and drinking in San Diego is in North Park at the corner of 30th and Adams. You can choose from craft cocktails at Polite Provisions, Mexican food and mezcal, margaritas at Cantina Mahuel, ramen at Tajima, and Southeast Asian food at Nude Bar. That's N-O-O-D, as in noodles. Each of these places is a top three or so for its respective cuisine. Third, related to the second, the best bites or individual dishes in San Diego are the spicy sesame ramen at Tajima, duck confit at Le Bon Table in Hillcrest, the chicken fried steak at Waterfront in Little Italy, the carne miste platter for two at Rovino in Little Italy, and the ribeye taco at Cole Brothers in downtown. Thanks so much, Justin. And I'll put all of his suggestions in the show notes of this episode at amateurtraveler.com. And with that, we're going to end this episode of Amateur Traveler. If you have any questions, send an email to host@amateurtraveler.com, or better yet, leave a comment on this episode at amateurtraveler.com. And thanks so much for listening.